And then, of course, here is where we have to come back to history. We know that the cattle industry was not made by Southerners, nor was it really made by Westerners. It was made by Southerners who became Westerners, and it started, of course, when, before the Civil War, certain white Southern plantation owners had exhausted their lands through bad agricultural methods and so on, and they went west. They went into Texas and they took their slaves. And of course, you couldn't have a lot of Negroes hanging around when there was no cotton to be picked. So you put them up on horses and you made cowboys out of them. And that's how that happened. It's much simpler and yet much more exciting than the rather empty myth, which is has now served far too long to disguise the actuality of the experience. Well, I'm going to make a rapid jump from the suppression of memory to another factor, which I feel is very important in the conflict of culture in this country, and which in our time, I think, is preventing some of the rich possibilities of the conflict to achieve themselves. And that is, when you look at American history linearly, you realize that as we roll west, and now as we roll north, and thank God it's now again as we are rolling south, we suppress certain things. We suppress certain realities. We suppress the excitement of the conflict. And what we get as history, what we get as cultural history even, is the story told by the people who are most articulate and who have the most power. And thus you get the idea that in the South, for instance, because one group dominated politically and economically, that they dominated culturally. But this is where we are thrown off. No one is thrown off more than a New York Jew who encounters a Southern Jew who's lived there for years and years. He doesn't know what to do with him because he's dealing with a Southerner who, yet, is a good Jew. He's sometimes better in terms of religious practice than some of the New Yorkers. But this metamorphosis, this adaptation of peoples to the concrete conditions of living goes on and on and on, and it changes not only from generation to generation, but it changes within generations. Then you have the other problem, which we get from the people who are most articulate. An Oklahoma City Negro boy who is educated thinks automatically that he knows more about the reality of what happened than some old codger who perhaps can hardly spell his name, and he tends to approach that man with arrogance. And of course, this is the arrogance of literate cultures. We like to forget that culture can be highly conscious and produce even great works of art without being literary. So this is another trap that we fall into, and it makes, not only for misunderstanding, but it makes us lose the meaning of the experience, and it also allows us to let very important cultural creators of culture die. And suddenly, years later, we say, well, my God, old Mr. So-and-so knew exactly what this meant. I find this very, very close to my own experience, because a man named Roscoe Dungey died at the age of 82 last month. And Mr. Dungey, years and years ago, when I was a boy, a little boy, going barefoot, selling his newspaper, wrote editorials in which he emphasized again and again that the hope for things, as far as we are concerned, and my own group, lay within the Constitution, that we must insist that the guarantees of the Constitution be lived up to. And he was a very sophisticated mind. I have recently reread some of the editorials which I clipped. There they were. Here was a continuity between whoever else it was, I don't know, but we can say roughly that it went back to the Reconstruction period, before Negroes became second-class citizens, when they were only slaves and thought that when they were freed, emancipated, they would become responsible citizens without all the rigmarole in between. But it's that kind of loss of continuity, a sense of continuity, which is so very, very important, and it's very, and which is so very destructive. And this leads to the other thing, which I started to get to, is the constant waves of immigrants who have so enriched our lives, and who have come in, but very often, thanks to the mobility of our society, have not felt the necessity of not only not of being responsible for what the past has done, but by they very often fail to take sides, fail to understand what all the conflict, what all the uproar was about. And this has led to a certain impoverishment of the literature. And not only is this true of immigrants, it's true of Negroes born in the North. A very famous Negro writer has tried recently to write about racial conflict in the South. And of course he fails everywhere he turns, and he fails not from a lack of talent, but out of a great arrogance, which assumes that intellect is enough, that you don't have to really obey one of Henry James's great laws, is that you must get felt life into your writing. And again, he fails Hemingway's dictum that you must write only about that which you know. The man didn't know it, and the imagination cannot create it out of the whole cloth. And no matter how sound your values are, no matter how sound your talent is, if you don't know how people confront people, if you don't know the manners of the region, if you don't know the nuances of the language, if you don't know the background behind that little part of the iceberg, shall we say, that sticks above the water, then you're in trouble. You are violating the possibility, that is, you're initiating the possibility which comes when the sophisticated mind encounters the experience which is unstructured and which is full of conflict, which is rich with possibilities of new definition. I think I've gone on long enough about this, and I'll try to say it very simply. I think that the meaning of cultural conflict in the United States has very often been one of creative enrichment, wherein the values of various people have come together, and out of the clashing, out of the fighting, has evolved a principle of selection which promises and in many instances has made possible a more human way of dealing with the problems of the modern world announced in our country with the very founding of the country. On the other hand, I feel that the failure to know the history, the failure to be concerned with what really happened, and very often this is because we're only interested in power, and not in basing power upon a sound knowledge of reality. We vitiate, we create needless conflicts, and more than that, we demean our fellows. And by demeaning our fellows, we inevitably demean ourselves. And in the long run, we produce art which does not live up to the promise which I feel exists for all who deal with the complex situation with a full sense of its delicacy and with a full sense of the complexity of human possibility which is available to us.
Custodian in a bank who stood and watched a group of bandits come in, enter the safe, walk out with the loot. And when examined by the police, they said, "Well, what happened?" Well, he said, "I was standing there. They came by and they got the loot. And then what did you do?" Well, he said, I leaned on the mop handle. And then they said, "What did you do?" Well, then I said, "I thought that was a devil of the way to run a bank." Now, I can just imagine this situation. We've done a fine job here. We got the glasses and we got the pitcher.
For about 15 minutes of my ramblings.
I'm not sure that that was the method in the madness. Seldom is a university privileged with a member on the faculty who has devoted a large part of his scholarly life in the study of the works of a speaker who will be with us. And it is our pleasure to have with us Professor Donald Kaufman of the Department of English, who has done just this, and to him I am turning the pleasure of introducing our next speaker.
In this wildlife land, I believe there are two possible ways of apprehending reality. There's the worm's eye view and there's the bird's eye view. And I would like to begin with the worm's eye view, with something called advertisements for myself. Mr. Mailer, in his own advertisements, commenting on a typographical error, the word sapping, misprinted as slapping, in the class report during a Harvard reunion, Mr. Mailer states thus, quote, "As the years go by and I become a little possible for PhD Mills, graduate students will begin to write about the slapping of my creative rage, of Mailer's vision of his rage as a shield, when what I was trying to say was simply, this shits are killing." Mr. Mailer goes on. "Now, in the writing of our days, when no ache of evidence can ever be believed unless it is presented by a doctor of jargon, a remark like, the shits are killing us, is so declarative that 50 pages of closely reasoned argument should follow in support." I quote, "I went to the state of Alaska and Texas, the university, and this audience to know that I have thus far only written 49 pages. If I go to Hawaii, page 50. And if they bring you on the Virgin Islands of the Union, let's make it 51. And now for a bird's eye view of a man and and a writer. Dora Miller's own favorite sentence is as follows. It is the actions of men and not their sentiments that make history. And I believe if you view Dora Miller's work in its entirety, it contains a great amount of historical perspective. Action, 7 works on the shelf, very substantial action. You also find within these 7 works a lot of intellectual versatility, a versatility that seems to cover almost every facet of contemporary existence. Mr. Miller does not write a cliché book. His books are not slick. Mr. Miller is not one of the literary writers where the doctor of jargons can say, class, there are 5 or 6 essential ideas. Write them down. Take your exam. This is not so. If you read Mr. Mailer's 7 books, think of the bifocal vision. Of course, there's always that so-called universal timeless element. And coexistent with this element is a very, very profound view of contemporary problems, our milieu, our times. I also would like to point out that if we can restrict the concept of heroism and the hero to mean cultural survival, I think it's very fitting to state that Mr. Mailer's literary output indeed does represent historical heroism. An earlier believer in heroism, Ernest Hemingway, makes this statement, all stories, if continued far enough, end in death, and he is no storyteller who would keep that from you. In Mr. Mailer's recently published novel, American Dream, Mr. Mailer has begun with death, has begun where Hemingway's fiction has ended. And what about Dora Miller, the man? I've had the privilege to read virtually all criticism, all book reviews, all so-called commentators, and I am appalled how little they deal with his work and how much they love to deal with a very, very unseen side of his life. The critics and reviewers and commentators really do seem to understand him too quickly. Once Mr. Mailer alluded to a political fact in the presidential papers to ex-President John F. Kennedy with this remark, how can, quote, you invade a country without understanding its music? And I would like to suggest to many of Mr. Mailer's readers and critics, how can you criticize a man without understanding his personal music? On the basis of yesterday's direct contact with Mr. Mailer, I believe I now understand this man's personal music. It is a very rare blend of virility, awareness, and sensitivity. And this man has referred to himself as a non-Jewish Jew, an alienated American, an existentialist without a portfolio, Mr. Norman Mailer.
The last time Ralph Ellison and I spoke from the same platform was the state of Iowa, at Iowa University of Iowa. And I remember being intrigued and fascinated with the audience, which I thought was a marvelous audience. They were very intelligent and very aware, and very alert. And they were full of applause for all of us. And they listened very they listened carefully. They thought about what we said. And I went around the state of intoxication with the state of Iowa for a day. You know, I thought, these Iowans are marvelous. And then I found out that practically everybody at the university was a graduate, came to our lectures, our symposium, was a graduate student and came from places like Wisconsin, New York, California, Indiana, and so forth, and very few were from Iowa. So before I go any further, I want to know by a hand count, how many of you are from Alaska? And how many of you plan to live here? And how many of you have very little to do with Alaska, except for the fact that you're at the college? So I am talking to a group of Alaskans in that case. Well then, in that case, I'm prepared to pull a stunt. And the reason for this stunt is because I think you have a very attractive flag. Now, there are not too many artifacts in the state of Alaska. I'm not talking about the nature of this state. I'm talking about the artifacts, things that people made here that are beautiful. This flag is. So I'm prepared to stand behind it. All right, now, when Ed Skillings came to New York a couple of months ago and called on the phone in his formidable, breezy fashion, and said, "Say, boy, I got some news for you. You're going to Alaska." And I said, "You're kidding." And with a sense that I was making a profound mistake, I invited him over for a drink. And then we got drunk, and I told him I'd come and say Alaska if, and I gave him something I thought he couldn't produce. It was a stunt of some sort. And he produced it, and here I am. Now, the slight embarrassment is that the topic, conflict of cultures, is something that I think all writers think about a great deal, and I imagine I've thought about it a good bit. But what gave me great pause is that I'm a city man, and I don't understand anything at all about a place like this. So I came here with great modesty and great uneasiness, because I felt that all the things I have to say are primarily things that I've learned living in a city which, for better or worse, is one of the real capitals of the world. And the way in which things work in that city is so profoundly different even from a city like Chicago that when I began to think of what it would be like in Alaska, that is, in other words, not what it would be like in terms of whether I would enjoy it or not, but what it would be like in terms of trying to talk back and forth and really talk about things, I have felt a great pause. Because if I can give an example of the difference between New York and Chicago even, New York is a perfect sociological structure. In other words, so far as that is possible, New York has evolved a complete sociological structure. In other words, if you go to a restaurant which would be considered one of the best restaurants in New York, you can, if you've had any experience in New York, almost describe in advance what the maitre d' is going to look like. And if you've had any sense of yourself, you also know how he's going to treat you. He will know in an instant exactly how much you make and where you belong and what sort of table you should get. And when you order the wine, you've got a fearful problem on your hands because of, unless you do it just right, you're going to be built slightly on the wine, because that would be the pleasure of the waiter who serves you. You would feel a fine contempt for someone who knows a little less about the wine than he knows serving it, and so forth. Now, there's nothing terribly new in this, because after all, the French novel is almost built upon this sense of the capital and the provinces. But the difference is that when you go to Chicago and you go to the best restaurant, you can't describe the maitre d' in advance, because very often the maitre d' isn't working there just 2 days. And what happened is he's a big fat guy with a sweet smile on his face and a cigar in his mouth, and his uncle bought the joint from the gangster that was knocked off 2 days ago. And he's his uncle's nephew. And he's very happy to run this place. It serves very good food and he's got a lot of class. And when you order the wine, they come over after and they ask you if you liked it, and is it a good wine, and what kind of wine should they order? Now that's Chicago. So I said to myself, well, what the hell is Alaska going to be like? And you can see why I felt a certain hesitation about addressing him with authority. But I felt it was worth it for one reason, before I came here even, which is that the simplest and most immediate remark that can be drawn from a title, Conflict of Cultures, is that conflict of cultures has meaning only to minority groups. People who exist at the center of a culture, and they are always the people who in effect wield the power in a culture, are not terribly aware of a conflict of cultures. It's only people who are on the periphery of a culture, or who straddle two cultures, or who belong to a culture which is outside the dominant culture, who are aware of this phrase, conflict of cultures. So I thought, well, if they're posing this as the topic of discussion for the night, then obviously everybody who lives in Alaska is a member of a minority group. And I thought, all right, fine, then I can talk to them. You know, one minority group can always address another because their abstract experience is similar. Now, you may then well ask, well, what is a minority group? You know, if you want a further definition of it, I'm going to do something which gives me great pause again, because in New York, I know I could get away with this. And they would say, in effect, oh, well, you know Norman Mailer, he always does things like that. But up here, people are very proud and they're very modest, and they tend to not advertise themselves at all. And so it strikes me as being, at the very least, in the most questionable taste to talk about something as personal as this. But nonetheless, I think it will be the best way to get into the thing I really like to talk about the rest of my time, which is what indeed is a minority group. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to, begging your pardon and taking the great liberty, I'm going to read a few reviews from my last novel, An American Dream. And at the end of it, I'm going to ask a question, so please listen carefully. This review appeared in the Hackensack, New Jersey Call. And it's titled, A Vulgar Bore. The first thing one must do after reading An American Dream is to bathe. He must wash his hands and mouth, sterilize his mind and spirit. This is an unbelievably filthy, vulgar book. No four-letter word is spared. No sex act consummated that isn't described in detail that borders on pornographic. There's probably nothing good to be said for An American Dream. And the reader will surely ask himself where Mailer got the title for this